media. 1-877-500-5266. If you want to see Silas Weir Mitchell and Constellations at Portland Center Stage at the Armory, give us a call for $120, $10 a month pledge right now, or membership. 1-877-500-5266. It would be great to hear the phones ring in the next 10 seconds that takes you to dial 1-877-500-5266.
You've been listening to Stage and Studio. Stage and Studio has been made possible by KBOO members and a grant from PD Expendables Stage and Studio Supplies. PD Expendables sells and rents to film and theater production, from gel and globes to paint and lights, featuring the latest Arri LED lighting. They can be reached at 503-887-5880 or pdexpendables.com. And now, Art Focus is up.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. Join your friends and neighbors and become a member of this powerful radio community, KBOO. This is our spring membership drive, and we're asking you to become a member today. Call 877-500-5266 right now. My guest this week is Randy Gregg. He is talking about Quest for Beauty, the architecture, landscapes, and collections of John Yon. The show is on at the Portland Art Museum through September the 3rd. Randy is the curator of the show, and he's the executive director of the John Yon Center for Architecture and the Landscape. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
You bet. Happy to be here.
This show is about a great architect from Oregon. The name Yon, Y-E-O-N, is pretty familiar to people, but I don't think you can see a lot of John Yon's buildings around town. And the two that I think are best known are the Visitor Center on the front, Waterfront Park, which is a sort of blue, low slung wooden building, and never quite know what goes on in there. And the other one is the Watzek House in the West Hills, which has fantastic views of the east side. But it's owned by the University of Oregon, and you can't just sidle up and have a look. So just tell us, what is it about these two buildings that sort of encapsulate what Yon did?
Well, the Watzek House, which was completed in 1937, is for one, Portland's only National Historic Landmark house, which is a kind of echelon above being on the National Register. And it's really an icon of early American modernist architecture. It is a beautiful piece of craftsmanship in native woods. It's a house of rooms, each one articulated in a really beautifully crafted details. But fundamentally, there's a modern rigor to the whole thing. And this house sort of emerged at a time. It was completed the same year as Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water and Alvar Aalto's Villa Marais. And it represented a sort of more localized response to the international style of modernism. There was sort of a pushback against the idea of the machine age, and that architecture should be rooted in the materials and the values and the landscape more. And this house really embodies that. And Yon, along with Pietro Belluschi, were doing a number of houses during this period that really represented that trend. And so it's kind of, very important. One of the first, the most widely published by far at the time, because it was embraced by the Museum of Modern Art. So it became, just this important icon for both a Northwest modernism, but also an American modernism.
Mm-hmm. Was there even a Northwest modernism then at
no,
the time?
No, hardly at all. I mean, you know, certain architects were kind of experimenting, you know, with more, you know, refined minimalist details. But this one really kind of set a very high standard. And then again, because of its remarkable publication history during the late 30s and the 40s, I mean, it was in all the magazines. It was, you know, international. It was published by the Museum of Modern Art five times in different books. So at that moment, it really, you know, set the kind of fireworks off for Jan's career, and also for kind of bringing the spotlight to this more localized notion of modernism.
And that was that based on that one photo with the mountain in the back, sort of reflecting the gable?
Yeah, most definitely. That was the most published photo. It was taken by a local photographer named Walter Boychuk, kind of by accident. He just happened to be strolling by, but it was such a strikingly resonant image with the peaks of the roof kind of echoing the angle of Mount Hood. So it really caught the eye of a lot of editors.
Mm-hmm. But the house itself, you see it from other angles, and it has these sort of, they look like 2x4s, you know, holding up the front. Was that the impact too?
Yeah, the house has a beautiful portico that faces east, and the columns are actually much larger than that, and they're at the top, they're mortise and tenon joints, so you see this beautiful joinery, and at the bottom the module, the distance, the columns are carried into the landscape with pavers into a kind of beautiful grassy terrace, and so that was another very iconic image and features prominently in the exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
The visitor center was Jan's only public building, and it was actually built on what was then Harbor Drive as a Chamber of Commerce sort of tourist center. They had galleries devoted to, you know, the sites of Portland and Oregon. But what was interesting about it, it's a little bit, you might describe it as Portland's Barcelona Pavilion, which was by Mies van der Rohe, but it sort of took an idea of a courtyard and an attitude towards space and volume in architecture, and really Jan built it in local materials out of plywood and you know, simple 2x6s, and it really addressed the river. Up to that time, the river had been largely a sort of industrial corridor, and there was this highway along there, and there was this, you know, beautiful terrace in which you can actually look out on the river. So it was also published widely in Progressive Architecture and by the Museum of Modern Art in the 1950, built in the USA. So it's in the last page of this book produced by the Museum of Modern Art that has all of the sort of mid-century, you know, icons of that era: Frank Lloyd Wright's Johnson Wax Laboratory building, Falling Water, all of these different, you know, just incredible icons, the Lever House in New York, and Pietro Belluschi's Equitable building. So it was running in pretty high company at that time.
Wow. And yeah. Is it today, is there something going to happen to it? Well, you know, what is the status of it?
Well, it's had a rough history for a lot of reasons. The Chamber of Commerce ultimately left it. The city had offices there for a while, but didn't take very good care of it. Like many buildings of that era that had flat roofs, it had leaks. The Columbus Day storm took out the beautiful trellis that had become overgrown with roses, and it was rebuilt sort of poorly. And then it became a restaurant when the park came. And Jan at one point actually testified rather eloquently for why it should be torn down, because he didn't believe it could be modified as a restaurant and keep the architectural idea of it. But the city, it was already a landmark at that point in time, and the city didn't do that. And a few years ago, quite controversially, City Commissioner Randy Leonard sunk some Water Bureau money into a restoration, and now the Rose Festival is there. Mm-hmm. You know, we got a little ways toward actually restoring it, however painful that was for the Water Bureau.
So this guy, John Yon, his dad made a lot of money in lumber and then built the Yon building downtown, which mm-hmm. was the biggest office building at the time. And he seems to come out of nowhere. In his 20s, he's designing things. And tell us the story about the Coast Road that he you know, didn't want to see.
Well, in a sense, you know, he grew up around these, you know, big characters, Simon Benson and Samuel Lancaster, and his, you know, John Yon the Elder, his father actually oversaw the construction of the Columbia River Gorge Highway and kind of saved it. It might not have got built. But for him. And so he grew up in this context of people making huge gestures in the landscape and really thinking about the beauty, because the Columbia River Highway was designed to be the most beautiful road in the world. Mm-hmm. And so, and then John traveled with his father as Oregon was building roads. And so he saw a lot of the natural landscape before, you know, anyone else was there. So as a young man, after his father died, he began to become an activist, and he started letter writing campaigns, and you know, he had a prominent address in the Yon building. But at one point, there was a highway being planned for Neocony Mountain that was going to blow away a significant chunk of the mountain. And John lobbied against it and proposed an alternative design that was more sensitive to the mountain and inspired by his father's work on the Columbia Gorge Highway, and went up against R.H. Baldock, this road engineer, and he wasn't interested in listening to a 23-year-old, 24-year-old at that time. And so John actually went over his head and flew to Washington, D.C., and lobbied the Federal Highway Department's landscape architect. And since the money was federal money that was paying for the highway, the landscape architect prevailed upon the engineer to change the design. And ultimately, Condi McCulloch, the famous bridge designer, designed the road. And there's this wonderful letter in which he writes to this young man and says that he could not possibly improve upon his design. And mm-hmm. the Neocony Road we have now, which is not as dramatic as John's model of the highway could have been, but it's way more sensitive and is very reminiscent of the Columbia Gorge Highway in that stretch. Mm-hmm.
Where is it exactly?
It is just north of Manzanita.
Mm-hmm. So was his thing, you know, you go around mountains and you don't tear up dunes, or, you know, what type of sensitivity?
Well, he was really about the view. I mean, he was really informed by, you know, the tradition of the picturesque. So, for instance, even before the Neocony Highway, there was a piece of property called Chapman Point, just south of Ecola State Park, that came on the market. And when he couldn't prevail upon the state to buy the land, John cashed in an insurance policy, a life insurance policy, and bought the point himself. Mm-hmm. And he ended up acquiring a half a mile of the Oregon coast around there, and ultimately Chapman Point, which is this sort of spit of land that juts into the view south from Ecola State Park, was preserved in that view corridor as a result of John Yon.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Randy Gregg. He's the executive director of the John Yon Center for Architecture and the Landscape. And he's here talking about Quest for Beauty, Architecture, Landscapes, and Collections of John Yon. So John Yon was an activist as much as a designer. What did he do in the gorge? You've said that he was very important in the way we even think about the Columbia River Gorge today.
Well, as a result of his successful activism, he was appointed to a committee that was looking at the long-term future of the scenic resources of the gorge when the Bonneville Dam was being built. And he chaired that committee at age 25 and wrote two important reports in 1935 and 1937 that together really comprised the first environmental impact statement ever really done for the gorge and probably in the Pacific Northwest. And they look at everything from road design to wildlife corridors to land that should be acquired, because I mean the gorge is so interesting because there's so many high promontories. It's the vistas are really one of the most important things about it, and you know, even articulated how the roads should be designed to be seen from above. So you know, cut and fill straight lines was the prevailing road ethos at that time, and John all of his life lobbied for curves, partly because he felt they were safer, but mostly because of how it would affect the view, that it was more beautiful. And so those reports kind of established the idea. You actually see the outline of what eventually became, the land covered, the part of the gorge covered under the National Scenic Act. In 1965, he bought a piece, 78 acres, directly across from Multnomah Falls, and it was zoned industrial. And was on the market as an industrial property. And he bought it, and it was an old farmstead that had been taken out by the what we call the Vanport Flood, the flood of 1948, and had kind of gone to seed. And John shaped it into a picturesque landscape, kind of in the tradition of the great English gardens, but a very Northwest version of that, mm-hmm. a kind of edited landscape.
Was it down at river level, or is it higher?
Yeah, and the prominent feature of it is this amphitheatrical berm that is kind of part earthwork and part just picnic amphitheater, and it directly faces the falls.
Natural?
No, he made it. It's got grass on it, and it was throughout the property. He created all of these view corridors that you could see, these little keyhole cuts and trees that you could see the falls. It's sort of like a hide and seek game with Multnomah Falls, and this became, it was his sort of private park, but he would bring people there to recruit them to the cause of the Columbia Gorge, and one of whom was Nancy Russell, who in turn recruited a bunch of folks to what became the Friends of the Columbia Gorge. And this was an important moment. And we've done two books with the exhibition, and one of them is devoted to John's conservation legacy. It's called John Young Landscape. And Bowen Blair, the founding director of the Friends of the Columbia Gorge, has written a wonderful essay just about how important that moment was. If John had not recruited Nancy to the cause of the gorge, things might look very, very different there, because I-205 was coming in, properties were on the north side in Washington were being subdivided, put on the market, and it would be a very, very different place had it not been for that just absolutely pivotal effort.
It would have had more houses and railroads and roads, freeways and things.
Very much, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
There are some amazing pictures that as you go in, there's just a huge photo mural of the coast, which so big. It's just incredible.
Yeah, that's Chapman Point.
Right. And then, like an architectural show, there are models in cases and there are photos and plans. But there's also the collection. So he collected a lot of Asian art and European art. And this is sort of sprinkled about through the exhibition, which is so interesting. You'll see a chair, and then you'll see a classical statue or neoclassical statue. Who worked with you on that, curating that?
The museum's curator of European and American art, Dawson Carr, and Mary Beth Grable, who is the curator of Asian art at the museum. And it was so much fun working with them. They know the material so well. And as they have described it, John was an eclectic collector. But he was really an important collector just because of the acuity of his understanding, both visual and of the history of these objects. And so there's, you know, spectacular objects in the exhibition that range from Ming Dynasty furniture to beautiful Japanese lacquers to Rococo sculptures. And the thing about Jan is he very freely mixed these things together in displays. And we couldn't possibly do it with the charm and beauty and often humor that he did it. But we did a little bit of it, and I should say they did it because they know the material and sort of oversaw those galleries. And then in the architecture exhibition, we sort of sprinkled a few objects just to get that juxtaposition, because so many of his buildings, his houses, you know, were almost essentially backdrops for art. He often styled his own photographs for the architecture press.
So, yeah, he would bring his own stuff in when he completed a building.
The Watzek House, his first house, which he ultimately bought back in the early 70s.
Oh, when an Watzek architect died. Who lived in his own house?
Yeah, somebody put it, he collected himself, because he had two houses that he had designed that he bought back from clients. But the Watzek House just became this kind of playground for he and his partner, Richard Lewis Brown, to arrange the objects. They're sort of the early Watzek House that, you know, looks like the modernist masterpiece that you see in the pictures. And then there's what I call the high style Watzek House, in which it's just replete with amazing objects. And there's some pictures of that phase of the Watzek House in the exhibition.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's very unusual. He's not your typical modernist, doctrinaire modernist architect.
Right. So you've produced two books, John Jan Landscape and John Jan Architecture. So you wrote the introductory essays, mm-hmm. and you had other people write other essays. And these are for sale where?
You can get them at the museum shop and then all the usual online sources.
mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And do you think Jan has a profile beyond the Northwest?
We're seeing a lot of interest. Yeah, he was not a self-promoter, and pretty much left architecture in the late 50s, and primarily devoted his time to designing museum galleries in San Francisco and at the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City, and to his collections, and then to his conservation activities. And so he was, you know, he was had means. And he was ambivalent about self-promotion, and so mm-hmm. he kind of fell away from the history of architecture. And there's a certain generation, you know, that knows of him, but I think there's a generation that's going to discover him. And I've been involved with the properties for 25 years now, and I've every time, you know, an opportunity came to bring a curator or a critic or a prominent architect up to the properties, I've always done that. And it's just this revelation, because people just don't know about him. I mean, Portlanders don't know about him. It's, you know, the house, you know, has only recently been regularly on display through tours.
The Watzek House. So you can go on a tour with the U of O, right?
Mm-hmm, you can get on our website and be notified of the tours. And there's a sort of standing last Sunday tour.
So two other things. Mm-hmm. Talk about postmodernism briefly and talk about performance.
John, his architecture kind of fell into two genres, you might say. One was what he humorously called the barn style. So these were houses that were really built to fit into the landscape. They were informal in plan, and they were really about shaping a kind of almost extension of the landscape. But he was at the end of the day, he was a contextualist, and he believed that architecture should fit in wherever it's built. And so there's another style that he calls the palace style, and again, tongue firmly in cheek, that is has a lot of historic motifs in it. And the one house that most embodied that and also got built, because many of them didn't get built, was the Shaw House, which was unfortunately remodeled some years ago and isn't sort of recognizable as a Jan house, but it looks like a Chinese pavilion. And it was on a hilltop in Lake Oswego, and had this, you know, extraordinary landscape move in it, and is you know, just like nothing you've ever seen. It's also often been called sort of, I don't know, as a described as a precursor to postmodernism, and Jan was not interested in the postmodernists at all.
He lived long enough to know to read about it in the Sunday papers.
He, as he described it, I'm not a member of that club.
And then performance?
Well, you know, it's interesting. All of his houses have passive ventilation systems. He did a series of the first production plywood houses in the entire country that also used thermoplane windows and radiant heat floors. And so he understood sustainability before we even called it that. But those were just means. He was really about beauty. All of his houses have these extraordinarily beautifully, sometimes simple and inexpensively articulated moldings. And, you know, his attitude toward the landscape, you know, I mean, today we think about buildings and landscape, you know, in terms of performance. I mean, buildings, you know, need to, you know, be net zero and, you know, need to be sustainable. And landscapes need to be about habitat. John was interested in all that stuff, incorporated it, but his primary aim was to create things that were beautiful. And I think that that's maybe the takeaway that I hope people will have from this exhibition, is that we've kind of lost beauty as part of the conversation. And I hope by seeing this, people will be inspired to think about that deeply again, because it's important. I think, you know, performance makes us feel good. We fall in love with beauty.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Randy Gragg. He's the executive director of the John Yon Center for Architecture and the Landscape. And he was here talking about John Yon Quest for Beauty, Architecture, Landscapes, and Collections of John Yon. It's on at the Portland Art Museum through September the 3rd. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
Oh, thanks for having me. Real pleasure.
KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. I'm here with Fortunato.
Yeah.
And we fall in love with beauty, don't we? We fall in love with beauty.
Another great program this morning.
Yes, indeed.
Well, how informative about how much effect this man, John Yon, has here in the local area. I mean, involved not only with the gorge, but also in the coast, and the idea of building roads around mountains instead of cutting through them. Just an idea like that, to have to fight for that way back when. What a great program to listen to this morning, and it's brought to you because people like you have called up and supported this community radio station, this listener-supported radio station. And it's now time for you to do that. If you really got something out of this program this morning and the programs that we've had this morning, and you haven't subscribed, now is the time to go to the phone and call 877-500-5266. And some people have gone online.
And I'd like to thank Jonathan from Northeast Portland and Kathleen from Mount Angel, Oregon, who gave online at kboo.fm. Maybe you're listening right now and just enjoying this weather, which is unusual for these parts, isn't it? And it's quite relaxing. My pets have all decided to find a sunny spot and just lay out and soak it up. And maybe you're soaking it up, too. I would like to ask you to break from that reverie just for a moment and spend 3 minutes on the phone with us, because you understand how important this is. Maybe you've been listening for a long time. Maybe I can shout out to you and say, if you remember Julie Bernard doing Art Focus for all those years,
yeah.
Julie Bernard, who had the bravery to go out and talk about flag burning with Hell's Angels and get it on tape. Julie Bernard, who was just remarkable. If you remember that, why not call in? The number 877-500-5266. I'd like to ask you to see if you've got $25 in your bank account at the end of the month. If you do, well, why not donate to KBOO and all the things that we represent, all the things that we do, this vibrant community, which makes Portland much of what it is, this essential radio station, 877-500-5266. And if you can manage it, maybe you can up your pledge or start your new membership at $25 a month, which gives you a range of options here, but especially the KBOO hoodie, because it's nice and warm now, but it'll be chilly tonight. And if you go to a concert and get out late, you're going to be glad you have a zip-up hoodie. You can adjust your own temperature so easily. with those options, and it looks great. It's got the KBOO logo. Let me describe that logo.
Styling.
That's a KBOO Community Radio, it says in red at the bottom. It goes up in a grayish blue to a red star, which is pointed to by a radio tower. And the fact that it is a transmitting tower is made obvious by the red star behind it, which looks rather militant, I must say. And the yellow electric lightning bolts coming out of it. It's a great logo. And anyone who sees it will know that you are a contributor to KBOO. That's the only way you can get it. And we have your size. So why not call right now, 877-500-5266.
Hey, this just in, Jane in Northeast Portland and Judy in Southeast Portland, they have increased their sustaining membership.
That's more J's.
Yes. You're keeping track of all of
yes,
them.
Yes. I mean, okay, all right. So many
there
J's.
We go. You can do that too. You can.
It's J Day.
Yes. Call us up, 877-500-5266, and become a member of Community Radio. We'll only be able to stay on the air with your support. We can't do it without your help. Every little bit helps. You know, people, they can do like a $10 a month, they can do $15 a month, a $5 a month, but every little bit helps to keep the station on the air. And we've been doing this for, what, a week and a half now, and we're getting close to the end, but still we're creeping up on our goal for the operating funds, and I think we're going to make it. So we can only do it if you call us up. So pick up the phone, 877-500-5266. We really want you right now.
You know, it's true, Fortunato, what you say, that we can only do it with you. I mean, we could put it in a different way if we wanted to turn to the evil side. Well, we could get money from other sources. Yeah. You know, we could invite General Electric on board. We bring hideous things to life. But we don't do that.
No.
We try to stay honest, and we are a community radio station because you make those little individual contributions that over the years, over the decades, has kept us honest and kept us what we are. The way you join right now, the way that you join the people who care and who make the station what it is by calling, spending 3 minutes on the phone with us, letting us fill out our carbon copy at 877-500-5266. I urge you to take the 3 minutes, just 3 minutes, and pledge with us, and we'll find the right gift for you. I suggest the hoodie. I think that you'll enjoy having that. 877-500-5266. You know in your heart that you want to do it, and this is the time, because really, if you don't do it now, won't you put it off? Don't put it off. Call us right now. 877-500-5266.
A little bit goes a long way. You know, it takes time and expertise to put the stories together, the different programs that we have. And we're able to do that with the little bit that you contribute, or the lot that you contribute. It's just going to take a little while, but give us a call up, and it helps you all year round. It helps the whole station stay on the air. You'll feel better. You'll be like walking on air for the rest of the day. So call us up, 877-500-5266. Become a member of Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host Chris Hedges and Joe Sacco on Saturday, May 27th at 2 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Journalist Chris Hedges and award-winning cartoonist Joe Sacco wrote the best-selling book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt.